This week on Making Contact.
Soldiers never saw any reason to behave because there were no consequences.
It may be about a culture of impunity. It may be about we are not subject to the rules of international justice except when we want to be.
I didn't care about being killed. I was afraid of being tortured.
Until the 60 Minutes 2 report, late April 2004, very few people in the United States had even heard of Abu Ghraib. On this edition, we'll trace the seeds of the prison scandal to 9/11 and before. We'll hear from survivors of torture, human rights advocates, and a soldier. And we'll revisit official government reaction. I'm Amy Pomerleau, your host this week on Making Contact, an international radio program creating connections between people, vital ideas, and important information. Fifteen-year-old Ahmed Tarhassan was one of many from his village who were rounded up by the U.S. military and taken to the now infamous Abu Ghraib prison. He says there he was confined to a 3-by-4-foot cell, the size of a small bathroom stall, for 9 months.
They used dogs. Every day, a different soldier would enter with a dog to frighten us. Some kind of police wolf dog.
Specialist Ramon Leo with the 870th Military Police Company worked as a guard at the prison. The conditions at Abu Ghraib were substandard. Walls missing, no potable water or showers, just dirt and rocks. Nothing like you'd expect at a U.S. jail.
They were rioting for many different reasons, some for stealing toothbrushes, car theft, rape, murder, insurgency, or suspected insurgents, or being in the wrong neighborhood at the wrong time. If there was a shootout against American forces, they would arrest everybody that was around there.
General Antonio Taguba detailed in his 53-page report on the Abu Ghraib prison that there were, in his words, sadistic, blatant, and wanton criminal abuses. He presented his findings at the Senate hearings on Iraqi detainee treatment in early May 2004.
In simple words, your own soldiers' language, how did this happen?
Failure in leadership, sir, from the brigade commander on down. Lack of discipline. No training whatsoever. And no supervision. Supervisory omission was rampant.
So far, there's been about 100 documented incidents, many of which were graphically captured on film with smiling soldiers.
And now, a message from the President of the United States, George W. Bush.
Good morning. In recent days, America and the world have learned of shocking conduct in Iraqi prisons by a small number of American servicemen and women. These individuals had been given the responsibility of overseeing Iraq.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, in recent days, there has been a good deal of discussion about who bears responsibility for the terrible activities that took place at Abu Ghraib. These events occurred on my watch. As Secretary of Defense, I am accountable for them, and I take full responsibility.
The damage done to the reputation, the credibility of our nation and the armed forces has the potential to undermine substantial gains and the sacrifices by our forces.
I just want to know how far up this chain you're going to go. Are you going to limit this to people who perpetrated it, or are we going to get to the people who may have suggested it? Or
I have to say, and I'm probably not the only one up at this table that is more outraged by the outrage than we are by the treatment. The idea that these prisoners, you know, they're not there for traffic violations. If they're in cell block 1A or 1B, these prisoners, they're murderers, they're terrorists, they're insurgents. Many of them probably have American blood on their hands. And here we're so concerned about the treatment of those individuals. And
who can doubt that Iraq is better for being free from one of the most bloodiest tyrants the world has ever known?
It's now known that the top level of the Bush administration was aware of the situation at least since January, more than 3 months before Congress or the public were informed. In fact, a December 2002 memo from Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld approved interrogation methods such as stripping, humiliation, and using dogs to threaten. Rumsfeld ordered some of these methods to be curtailed after legal advisors told him these techniques are war violations. But it's unclear what interrogative methods were still sanctioned. In the week before the Senate hearings, Rumsfeld was far less apologetic. At a press conference at the Pentagon, he said it was deplorable behavior, but not torture.
I don't know if it is correct to say that what you just said, that torture has taken place, or that there's been a conviction for torture. And therefore, I'm not going to address the torture word. There's no question but that it has been my conviction that all of our rules, all of our procedures, all of our training is against abuse of people that are detained.
There are some fairly harrowing stories that have come out of Abu Ghraib of people being beaten almost to death, of people having their toenails pulled out, of people being raped. That is torture. There's no doubt about it.
Naomi Rote Ariasa is a professor of law at the University of California Hastings College of Law in San Francisco. Her specialty is international human rights.
I think rather than a culture of, war is hell, I don't think that's what this is about. I think it may be about a culture of impunity. It may be about, we are not subject to the Geneva Conventions. We are not subject to the normal rules that all other countries are subject to. We are not subject to the rules of international justice except when we want to be. I think that creates a culture of impunity where 18 and 19-year-olds now no longer know what the proper course of action is.
Specialist Leal says the torture wasn't systematic, yet what he describes reflects a culture of impunity. He approached his superior officers with grievances at least 10 times, he says. Those grievances usually regarded mistreatment of a prisoner. His superiors said they'd take care of it, but never did.
Before we even deployed to the Middle East, we were given a speech about how righteous we are, how justified invading Iraq would be. They take that, and then once they hit Iraq, they start believing that we are indeed helping them. They see the living standards, so they see how bad the situation is in Iraq, and they start seeing the people there as being subhuman. And when you take into consideration what Rumsfeld says, then they start believing, these people are subhuman and don't have rights, and so we should be treating them like this. Maybe they should be thankful for us putting them in prison.
The incidents of mistreatment are not unique to Abu Ghraib. Human rights groups have been criticizing conditions in prisons across Iraq since the war began. 57-year-old Zadiq Zoman Abrahim was an assistant manager at the hospital in Kirkuk when he was taken into custody after the U.S. military raided his home in 2002. After holding him a few months, the U.S. military dropped him off, in a coma, at a hospital in Tikrit. Dar Zamal, a journalist who reports for the New Standard News, has been helping the family.
The Army medic claimed that he had a heart attack, heat stroke, and hypoxia, lack of oxygen to the brain. But the Army doctor did not report any of the signs of the torture, the bludgeoning on the back of his head, the electrical burns on his feet and genitalia, and cigarette burn marks up and down his legs. So he was in, and he had a tracheotomy, and they had also had to perform a gastrostomy on him as well. And he was completely comatose, totally unresponsive to any stimuli, and remains that way today.
The doctors at the hospital found that Abrahim had suffered effects from massive head trauma and electrocution. His EKG was normal, indicating his heart was functioning perfectly. The family doesn't know why he was picked up. He was never charged with anything. The U.S. has signed a number of international treaties dealing with torture.
All of these are things that the U.S. has agreed to, and what's more, that the U.S. goes around the world talking about.
There's the UN Convention Against Torture, which the U.S. signed in 1994. The U.S. has also been party to the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights since 1992. It says no one will be subject to torture or cruel, inhumane, or degrading treatment and punishment.
So it covers not only torture, but also so-called abuse.
There are also several humanitarian law conventions that apply during times of war. The most important of which is the 1949 Geneva Convention, says Rote Ariaza. The Geneva Convention prohibits ill treatment of prisoners and civilians. It also requires that the International Red Cross see detainees.
One of the fundamental ideas underlying the Geneva Conventions is that they protect our troops, because there's an underlying concept of reciprocity, that if we don't do this to other people won't do it to our soldiers. So there's an idea of self-interest and self-preservation underneath the law of war. On the human rights side, the human rights treaties do have exceptions for times of national emergency. In times of war or national emergency threatening the life of the nation, there are certain rights that can be derogated from. But there are certain rights that are considered non-derogable. In other words, it doesn't matter whether it's time of war, national emergency, whatever, you cannot derogate from them, and the right to be free of torture is one of the non-derogable rights. Now, the Torture Convention, the drafters also thought about this question of war or national emergency, because, of course, governments, if they can get information easily, they don't torture. All governments that torture, first of all, say they're not doing it. Second of all, say they need to take these kinds of measures because there are exigent circumstances. There is no government that doesn't say that. So they thought about the question. And they decided that once you opened that door, there was no shutting it again.
But since 9/11, the Bush administration has asserted there are extenuating circumstances that allow the U.S. to circumvent or push the boundaries of international law and standards. That special times call for special needs. And Congress authorized the president to use all necessary and appropriate force in the war on terrorism. Barbara Olshansky is the deputy legal director for the Center for Constitutional Rights. Immediately after 9/11, people in the U.S. were being arrested. Her organization fielded calls from worried families.
We start hearing that people are disappearing. My husband, my brother, my son, my uncle, my cousin. And we try and find people. And we can't find them. We start in the police precinct, we go on and on through every agency, up to federal agencies, and we can't find them. These are people that overstayed their tourist visas or did some minimal amount of work while here on a tourist visa. Those are civil immigration violations, not too far off from a traffic ticket, really. People who violated those laws, we never in this country arrested them until now. They are people that went into the most onerous conditions in our federal, state, and county jails in this country, in solitary confinement for more than 23 hours a day, beaten, shackled, hands to waist to feet, short shackled to the floor, beaten while they were being interrogated. And when these folks went through their immigration process, when we could get them before an immigration judge, and they were granted the right to voluntarily depart from the country or to take removal or deportation, that didn't end their incarceration. All of these folks were then kept up to 2.5 years longer until they were cleared by the FBI. It was a policy called, we're going to hold until cleared. And you know, talk about turning things on their head. What happened to innocent until proven guilty? None of these folks had any criminal charge against them. There was no allegation that they were in any way affiliated with any terrorist activity, any organization, that they ever had been. Nothing, zero.
Meanwhile, the 600 or so people captured in Afghanistan were in a legal black hole at Guantanamo Bay for over 2 years. Stephen Cambone, Undersecretary of Defense for Intelligence.
According to the convention itself, those nations that are high contracting parties to the convention. Al-Qaeda is not a high contracting party to the Geneva Convention. It repudiates the rules of war. It operates against civilians. It doesn't wear uniforms. And it has never sought to be a high contracting party. The Geneva Conventions do not apply.
But many human rights advocates, like Olshansky, say these laws should apply.
lying behind this case is the question. When U.S. government officials act, wherever they act, aren't they bound by some law at all? And the position of the Bush administration is, no, they are not. No law at all applies to Guantanamo. And they really say this out loud. And what really is clear is that if you put these pieces together, that it was a very deliberate selection of Guantanamo Bay. And now we have all these internal memos that are being leaked that talk about this. But it was a deliberate selection of that island prison with the notion that the courts are never going to like want to hear a case from there. And we can make that argument. And we can also make the argument because we think they're terrorists. We didn't like the Taliban regime, even if it was the government of Afghanistan. And we're going to say they were never really soldiers, and therefore they're never prisoners of war. They don't get the Geneva Conventions, and therefore no law applies.
Now, former inmates of Guantanamo Bay are charging abuse and torture. All of this was under the supervision of General Jeffrey Miller, who's now the new head of the Abu Ghraib prison. Bush also authorized the CIA to create secret detention centers around the world. Olshansky says the military is allowed to use techniques not permissible in the United States.
We still don't know where all of those facilities where people are being held. We know many, many thousands of people are being held in those facilities. And, you know, your guess is as good as mine about what types of abuses and torture are going on at those places.
All we know is that there have been people who have said their family members have disappeared into these and have not been seen again.
Rotariaza says nobody knows if people are being held temporarily, indefinitely, or killed.
Disappearances are among the most heinous crimes in the history of the world. Court after court after court has found that a disappearance is a crime against humanity. It can be tried anywhere, forever. It is one of the worst possible crimes because it not only hurts the detainee, it hurts the community, it hurts their family. The family never knows what happened to them.
We'll continue with this program in a few moments. You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like a free listener packet on this topic, or to order cassette or CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. That's 800-529-5736. You can also visit our website at radioproject.org.
There's a long history of torture being connected to U.S. foreign policy.
Father Roy Bourgeois is a priest with the Mary Knoll Order.
As a young man years ago in Vietnam, I mean, I remember the pilots laughing, bragging about how they tortured the Vietnamese prisoners, the Viet Cong, how they were taken up in these helicopters over the jungle. They would have 10 or 12 of them, and they would simply question them by the door over the jungle. And if they didn't talk, they simply threw them out of the helicopter. And then the second would be questioned. If he didn't talk, he'd be thrown out of the helicopter. Then they thought it was funny because the third and the fourth and the fifth were giving them all kinds of information. Back then, I, you know, did not critique my country's foreign policy. It was such trust we had in those in Washington. And when they said that we should go off to Vietnam to stop the spread of communism, I had been in the military now for 3 years, out at sea for a couple years, at a NATO station for a year. And I thought this sounded good. They said our cause was noble, that we were going to be the liberators, the same language we're using, of course, today toward Iraq. And I bought into that lie and how easy it is for our leaders to take the lie and call it truth, to take the evil and call it good. And so I went to Vietnam, as many did, and it was a turning point in my life. The suffering, the violence, the death began to change me. And losing friends there, wounded there, I must say I began now to, for the first time, to question things, to look at my country's foreign policy for the very first time with critical eyes.
Bourgeois lost a lot of his hope there, but regained it through peacemaking movements and became a priest. He went to El Salvador, joined in solidarity with struggles of the working poor. He found that people were living in horrible conditions and suffered violence at the hands of the military.
I had more fear in El Salvador than I had in Vietnam or Bolivia. There was such an abuse of power. I mean, the knock, you know, coming on the door at night. It's the death squads. They're looking for the so-called subversives, the comunistas. They're the students. They're the campesinos, you know, who were paid $1 a day for picking beans for the oligarchy there, for the patrons. They're the religious, the spiritual leaders, human rights advocates, healthcare workers. They were the targets. Anyone who was critical of the military or of U.S. military aid there, and they were disappeared. They were killed, thousands. And they had no recourse to justice. They couldn't go, you know, to the local police station, get an attorney to defend themselves. It was something I had never seen before.
Several church leaders were killed there, including two nuns from his organization. Carlos Mauricio, a professor who was in El Salvador, knows all too well about torture. When he was picked up in 1983 by death squads, a special unit of the army, he knew his fate.
I didn't care about being killed. I was afraid of being tortured. So when they came and tortured me, I told myself, well, you know, I am dead. Because I knew it. I knew it. I have seen in San Salvador, I have seen hundreds of corpses thrown on the streets with signs of being tortured.
As international concern grew over massacres and violence, a U.S. congressional task force was formed. They found that many of those responsible for the atrocities were trained at the U.S. Army School of Americas in Fort Benning, Georgia. In September 1996, the Washington Post broke the story that from 1982 to 1991, the school used training manuals that instructed students on torture, blackmail, and execution. Father Bourgeois calls the School of Americas a terrorist training camp.
These soldiers came to the United States, again, all paid for by the taxpayer, to learn combat skills. They learned commando operations. They learned psychological warfare, counterinsurgency.
Every year in November, thousands gather at Fort Benning, Georgia, to protest the school. Now renamed the Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Cooperation, the school has graduated over 60,000 soldiers from 19 countries. It was the height of the Cold War. Mauricio says the United States focused its attention on Latin America out of fear another country would convert to communism, like the Soviet-backed Cuba did.
They kept asking me, "You have been in Cuba?" I say, "No, I never been in Cuba." But at that moment was very important to them to find Salvadorians confessing that they've been in Cuba, because Mr. Reagan was interested to show the Havana connection. So after several days of being tortured, I said, okay, that's all right. Okay, I've been in Cuba. Don't torture me anymore. And the guy said, you're an idiot. Why you didn't confess from the beginning? And then he said, now you are going to tell me who gave you the money. Who came with you, who gave you the passport, which is your connection in Mexico, and the name of the military training camp in Cuba. And I said, but I never been in Cuba.
He was one of the lucky ones, released alive after 3 weeks.
I believe that the United States was blind by the fact that we were not looking for exactly a communist regime in our countries. We were looking for justice.
Mauricio founded Stop Impunity, which organizes Salvadoran torture survivors to draw attention to human rights abusers in El Salvador and other countries. As the war began in Iraq, he saw in the nightly news the same exact techniques used on him: blindfolding, sleep deprivation, and beatings in an attempt to soften him up for interrogation.
For me, as a torture survivor, as a person who has already experienced war, I know that abuses are inherent to the war. You cannot have a clean war. You have to have rapings, killings, torture. It's impossible. That is war. That is the meaning of war. And when I saw the prisoners, the Iraqi prisoners being captured and being blindfolded by the USA Army, I knew it. I immediately began to have nightmares and problems, you know, because I got flashbacks of what happened to me.
He says the same people who are responsible for the atrocities in Central America are now in Iraq, like John Negroponte, former U.S. ambassador to Honduras, who assisted Central American death squads. Negroponte is now U.S. ambassador to Iraq. Father Bourgeois also draws parallels.
What really angered me was when the top general there said, addressed it. I'll never forget that interview when I was watching this on the national evening news. I think it was ABC. Well, these are just a few bad apples. It was verbatim what they said about, you know, the torture manuals and those who killed the Jesuits and the church women and El Masote, and the list simply went on and on. And that really angered me. But, it, you know, I must say they're consistent in telling the lies, you know, trying to downplay the evil and the seriousness of all of this.
In 2003, Mauricio won a landmark case in a U.S. court against the generals who were, through a chain of command, responsible for his torture. The generals were held liable for thousands of murders and countless acts of torture at the hands of the Salvadoran security forces during the country's 12-year civil war. He says the generals and the commanders in Iraq should also be held accountable.
The Bush administration and the commander of the army, they are trying to avoid their responsibility. And that is, for me, the importance of the people of the United States to fight for accountability, to make possible that those guys accept what they have done.
That's it for this edition of Making Contact. Thanks for listening. Special thanks to production interns Eric Klein and Susanna Hines. Thanks also to Jeff Conant, Bashar Kastandi, April Sinclair, Martha Baskin, Aaron Glantz, Dina McCabe, and Bruce Worth. Our theme music is by the Charlie Hunter Trio. If you'd like a free listener packet on this topic, or to order cassette or CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. That's 800-529-5736. You can also visit our website at radioproject.org. Lisa Rudman is our executive director, Justin Beck, associate producer, Brashan McKee, office manager, Dori Taylor, marketing and outreach coordinator, Peggy Law, founding director, Norman Solomon, senior advisor, David Barsamian, national advisor, and I'm your host and director of production and training, Amy Pomerleau.